dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence we're privileged to explore frequently is Robert Charles. He has had a tremendous amount of experience at senior levels of the United States government, including serving in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush White Houses, and most recently as an Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement. He contributes mightily to not only this program, but an awful lot of other outlets, including Fox News and FoxNews.com, on matters of great importance to our security and other national interests. And it's always a delight to have him with us. Robert, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Frank.
Robert, I wanted to catch you on a story that I'm not sure you've had a chance to see. Probably most of our audience hasn't either, but I think it needs to get, and hopefully will shortly, a lot of attention. It ran in the Financial Times today, reporting on a subject that one of our colleagues, Roger Robinson, has been warning up for some time, namely that we're putting money, unwittingly in most cases, money in the form of investments in the MSCI index, a product of Morgan Stanley, into communist China, and specifically into Chinese companies tied to the government there that are doing some very malevolent things, whether it's building fortified islands in the South China Sea or, you know, detaining Uyghurs or building nuclear-powered aircraft carriers or the like. And the latest news on this, Robert, which I wanted to just touch base with you on, because I think, like me, you're invested in the Thrift Savings Plan, the federal government's retirement plan. Apparently, come 2020, that plan is going to start having these Chinese companies in its portfolio as well, which would mean a lot of us would be investing in it, and I think doing so to our great peril. Your reaction to this news and thoughts about what we should do about it?
Well, Frank, I have only heard about that Financial Times story, and I will go through it today. But in principle, of course, it makes no sense for the United States of America or any of our citizens to be investing in a defense infrastructure which has become more and more offensive on the part of China. And you mentioned the South China Seas, which have now, you know, the original promise was they would not be militarized. They are being militarized, and they also represent a threat to international trade. And so it makes very little sense for anything that is tied to the U.S. government to be investing in something that's tied to the Chinese defense industry. That's essentially we'd call that in the law an admission against interest. That's an investment against interest. That makes no sense from the point of view of average Americans. I would also say that you always have to, you know, China is a bit enigmatic, but I think people need to remember that there are really, we hear a lot about one China, but there are really two Chinas. And I don't mean the one China policy with Taiwan. I mean, we hear a lot about the fact that China is the second largest economy. It's also a country that is profoundly oppressive of human rights. And I have friends with whom I debate this because they see the piece of it that's economically advancing. But the vast majority of China is actually subject to ruthless communist control. And I think it's something to understand that if you're investing in the Chinese defense companies, quote unquote, you're really investing in the Chinese government. And I don't think it would make sense for any thoughtful, knowledgeable, forward-thinking American to do that.
Yeah. Well, among the companies that is in this MSCI index and that would be under this plan in the Thrift Savings Plan is something called Hikvision, which is a very important part of the security state apparatus that the Chinese are using most egregiously, it would appear, in connection with these concentration camps where Uyghur Muslims are being detained by the millions. But as you say, Bobby, against the Chinese people more generally. And oh, by the way, they're in the business of exporting.
To be straightforward, the United States government, the United States corporate community, and United States citizens would never, should never, and I know never, contemplated the notion of investing in Soviet gulags or investing in the creation of MiGs that would fly against, you know, RF-14s at all back then. There's no question that this is an error in judgment. And if the thrift savings plan investment process can be relooked, I think this would be the appropriate time for that. And I think that maybe Congress should look into that directly themselves.
Yeah, well, the Financial Times story that broke this whole thing loose this morning credits Senators Marco Rubio and Jeanine Shaheen for already putting a flag down that they don't want this to go forward, and I think they will be working to undo it. So watch this space, and your help would be greatly appreciated. I did want to ask you quickly to pivot to a different topic. You've written recently, Bobby, about the president's mulling the idea of buying Greenland. Tell us what your thoughts are on that subject and the advisability of his mulling of this idea.
Well, you know, very often the words you use to describe what your interest is immediately either taint or enthuse the further discussion of that issue. And I think the notion that people think of President Trump as a real estate mogul who walks in, puts money down, and walks away with what he's looking for, that's really not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about is that Greenland is a country which is 80% covered with ice. It is a very strategically significant country for several reasons, not all of which are obvious. As China and Russia become, again, more vigorous in their anti-American thinking, having Greenland, number one, in our camp, we do have one base there, but in our camp, as a short route forward to be able to respond to anything that came at us from those countries, makes perfect sense. It also makes perfect sense not to allow the Chinese to do that. In 2018, they actually went in and tried to make major purchases. The other thing that is obvious, or maybe not so obvious, is that, it kind of backs up to the trade issue with China, because in reality, we need very little from China, and we need absolutely nothing from Russia. We're energy sufficient, self-sufficient. We have lots of things, but there are rare earths that China has that are of some value, although they also exist in Africa. Well, they also exist in Greenland. And in fact, there's a natural resources argument for investing heavily in Greenland and encouraging the people of Greenland to think out of the box. And that really brings me to the third point. Yes, it is a protectorate of Denmark, just as the United States has a number of protectorates. Historically, land has been purchased country to country with the consent typically of both the parent country, if you will, and the protectorate. The Danish West Indies became the U.S. Virgin Islands when we purchased them. It's not so out of the box in terms of whether it could or couldn't be done. The reality is that there is a sequence of steps that probably should be explored, not least because with the melting of some of the polar ice, it opens up trade routes that both improve the efficiency of trade globally, which is good for commerce, but it also opens up the possibility that China and Russia could become more active in the Arctic, and we need to be prepared for that.
Thank you for your time today, my friend. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. In the meantime, I appreciate what you do at AMAC and Fox News and elsewhere. Keep it up. Talk with you soon. Next up, we'll talk with Gordon Chang right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined as we have the privilege of being each week by Gordon Chang, one of our country's preeminent experts on Asia and most especially on communist China and what it is up to and what it might mean for all of us. Gordon is, of course, a best-selling author several times over, including The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and most recently, Losing South Korea. We are catching up with him in the wake of what can only be described as a wild ride over the weekend with the president at the Biarritz G7 meeting and comments going in, comments at, and comments coming out that have made a lot of headlines. And to help us decipher what it all means, if anything, I'm pleased to say we have Gordon with us. Gordon, thank you so much for taking a few minutes. I know how wildly busy you are, as the world wants to know what you make of all of this. So do we. Welcome back.
Well, thank you so much, Frank.
So we've got the Trump comments of last week, which described Xi Jinping as an enemy, which imposed new higher tariffs on a whole range of products, and which pretty strongly signaled that the president was, if anything, going to be even more determined to press China on the various, you know, activities and threats that it poses to us, not just in the trade sector. By the end of the G7 meeting, he's now talking about a trade deal, not just with Japan, but one in the offing now, he thinks, with China. What's up? And what do you think is coming next?
Thanks, Frank. The Chinese signal that they want to have substantive discussions with the United States when their chief trade negotiator spoke with President Trump and said that he wanted to have calm in negotiations. And then I interpret that as Beijing essentially understanding that they, at this moment, cannot continue their provocative stance towards the United States in the trade area. They've got right now multiple crises. They've got Hong Kong, which is breaking away from the People's Republic, and they've got a crumbling economy, which is not growing at the 6.3% pace claimed for the first half, may even be contracting. So right now, I think what they're trying to do is to hold the United States off. I'm sure that the political elements in Beijing that scuttled a tentative arrangement at the end of April and the beginning of May have not changed their views. But I think Xi Jinping now understands that he is not going to intimidate Trump into submission. In fact, I think it's the other way around. I think that President Trump's provocative comments in tweets on Friday, his increasing tariffs on China by 5 percentage points on various goods, and through other things that he's done over the weekend, has just shown the Chinese that they have at least met their match and that President Trump is not going to crumble.
Well, that's heartening, to say the least. The markets have been in a swivet over all of this, and we know he's paying attention to that. It's talk of recession and what it might mean for his reelection prospects. Gordon, you probably are as thoughtful and knowledgeable about what the Chinese stratagems might be in moments like this. Surely they can't be missing that fact that by tanking our economy, they can greatly intensify the pressure on him and presumably extract concessions. Is it your assessment that their own situation is so desperate that they can't actually play that card?
Yeah, I don't think the Chinese have very many cards at this moment. And clearly, President Trump took one of the most important of them away. And that was yesterday when he had announced an agreement in principle with Japan for Japan to buy about $7 billion more of U.S. agricultural products, including corn. As we all know, Beijing has stopped buying soybeans and was targeting the farm belt, going after President Trump's base. Now we're going to have American farmers being able to sell excess production to Japan and other places because we've got the USMCA, the trade agreement with Canada and Mexico. That's getting close to implementation. Also, President Trump talked about a trade deal with Britain post-Brexit, which would be Brexit is maybe October of this year. So I think China realized it just had run out of cards. That's not to say that the Chinese would honor any trade deal. I'm sure they're going to stall for various reasons. I'm sure they're going to cheat if there is a deal. But nonetheless, I think China right now understands that it is seriously outgunned. The only thing, Frank, and this was, they were always seriously outgunned, but the only thing, Frank, that China was counting on, that they had more political will. And that by far is the most important factor. Well, in Trump, they realized in the last 3 or 4 days that Trump has more political will than those guys do. So right now we've got all of the cards and we've got the political will. Beijing just realizes that resistance, at least at this moment, is futile.
From your lips to God's ears, Gordon Chang, I hope this is the right prognosis, and it certainly would be a tremendous credit to Donald Trump if he's actually brought them to this point. Let me just ask you a quick question, Gordon. I want to come back to Hong Kong, but on Japan and a trade deal with Japan, what does that mean, if anything, for the so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership in which Japan is a member and we no longer are?
That's a great question, Frank. And it's always a possibility, and there was always a possibility that the U.S. would rejoin it if its terms were renegotiated. So that's still, I think, something that could occur. But right now, what President Trump is doing, and U.S. trade negotiators have said this from the beginning of the administration, was that they were going to replicate the TPP with bilateral trade deals. And the thinking, and this is correct, that the United States has overwhelming leverage in each negotiation it would have with TPP partners. So very well, we may get to either a Trans-Pacific Partnership agreement itself or just agreements with the TPP partners on a bilateral basis.
Yeah, without all of the multilateral garbage that was associated with the TPP itself and that made it, I think, so objectionable for a lot of us. Very interesting. We'll be watching that closely, as I know will you, Gordon Chang. Let me turn to Hong Kong. You mentioned that Hong Kong is breaking away, I think is the way you put it, Gordon. The return to sort of violent protests over the weekend has ratcheted things up again. Somewhat smaller demonstrations, as I understand it, and some bloodletting. I gather nobody's been killed just yet, but it does seem as though people have been wounded and hospitalized and so on. Does this likely constitute conditions in which the government in Beijing finally has to, as it sees it, crack down violently and finally on this uppity Hong Konger operation?
The Communist Party came to power through violence and maintains power through violence, so it would normally like to use violence in Hong Kong. There are a number of factors that restrain that. One of them is that if they were to formally put the People's Armed Police or the People's Liberation Army on the streets of Hong Kong, it would be open warfare. And it might be a fair fight. So this would not be Tiananmen. It would not be just a slaughter of a people. It would be a struggle where casualties were high on both sides. That's one thing that inhibits the introduction or formal introduction of Chinese units. The other thing is, of course, a trade deal. They need a trade deal right now, or at least they need negotiations for a trade deal. And of course, that would be politically impossible in the United States if there were to be a formal introduction of units onto the streets of Hong Kong. So I think that that's not going to happen, at least for some time. But of course, that is always a concern. Got to remember, Frank, there are two groups of protesters. There are the young kids, the guys who wear black and gas masks and who are willing to fight. And of course, there's the overwhelming mass of Hong Kong middle class people. People we saw, for instance, on Friday when they formed the Hong Kong Way, which was 28 miles of human chains across the territory. So right now we saw both this weekend, both a big formal protest, which was peaceful, plus the kids in very, very aggressive tactics, both on their part and the part of the Hong Kong police.
Yeah. Gordon, you've emphasized the point of the formal introduction of the People's Armed Police or the People's Liberation Army. To what extent do you believe that the Chinese are actually insinuating those forces in covertly? They're in undercover garb. Maybe they're even precipitating some of this violence in the hopes of provoking conditions that would be conducive to, seen by others, including the outside world, as legitimating a more brutal crackdown.
Yeah, there's overwhelming video evidence on YouTube that for more than a month we've had either People's Armed Police or Hong Kong or Chinese Gongan, the regular police, or maybe even people from the People's Liberation Army on the Hong Kong streets wearing the uniforms of the Hong Kong police. There's been a number of instances where Hong Kong policemen in a Cantonese-speaking city cannot speak Cantonese. They can't show their Hong Kong police identity cards. There evidence of Hong Kong riot policemen talking to other riot policemen in Mandarin and also addressing them as comrade. So they're there, Frank. And also, of course, the Hong Kong police now, as a whole, are being administered by Beijing. Carrie Lam, the Hong Kong chief executive, top political officer in Hong Kong, she's not running things. So they're there, Frank. It's just that it's not in a formal way. And that's why I always try to use that word formal when I talk about the introduction of Chinese forces.
Yeah. And I gather that there's evidence as well that they're in no uniform at all. They're dressed more like the demonstrators in black or in perhaps white in some cases, like the Triad team. Much more to talk about, Gordon, though we are out of time to do it today. I appreciate so much your up-to-the-minute reporting and analysis, as always, and look forward to talking with you and seeing much of you elsewhere at Fox News, I'm sure, and so many other outlets. Thank you for taking a few minutes with us today. Come back to us again next week, if you would.
More with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I'm so pleased that we are joined by one of the men that I've come to admire most in American public life. He is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. He has served our country in a variety of capacities, notably as an analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency, as a congressional staff member in a variety of capacities. Perhaps his most important service, however, has been for many years working with and otherwise supporting the Congressional Electromagnetic Pulse Threat Commission, or EMP Commission. This has been a labor of love for Peter Pry. He has understood, as few others in our country have. He has done his homework about, he has helped the commission and others advance concrete recommendations concerning what to do about the threat we face from various quarters that could take down our electric grid through the use of, in one form or fashion or another, electromagnetic pulses. Peter Pry is the author of several really important books addressing this subject, including Apocalypse Unknown, Electric Armageddon, and most recently, Blackout Wars. Peter Pry, it's good to have you back. Welcome, as always.
Right back at you, Frank, on being a great American. Thank you so much for having me.
Great. It's our pleasure. So, Peter, you have recently written, as you are wont to do, a heads up about the threat we face from, as I say, various quarters. Specifically in this article, you were addressing North Korea as a possible source of an electromagnetic pulse attack. I've seen you describe not only what they could do with the ballistic missiles that they have now into the inventory over there capable of reaching the United States, but some other perhaps somewhat more exotic, but in some ways even simpler means of decisively taking down our country using this electromagnetic pulse phenomenon. Walk us through what you're concerned about on these scores.
One of the chief threats from North Korea that nobody seems to pay any attention to, except for the EMP Commission, is their satellites. You know, the North Koreans have a demonstrated capability to launch satellites into a south polar trajectory. In fact, they've got two satellites in more or less permanent orbit, the KMS-3 and KMS-4. To pass regularly over the United States at the optimum altitude to do an EMP attack and on the optimum trajectory to evade our national missile defenses because they come up from the south. You know, we don't have any ballistic missile early warning radars facing south, and our interceptors, you know, are designed for intercepting things coming over the north. So they've got a free shot at us by means of those satellites.
Just remind us, Peter, just to get back to the most basic aspects of this, how would a satellite at the optimal altitude deliver an electromagnetic pulse attack, and with what effect?
Well, we're concerned that that North Korea has probably also got super EMP nuclear weapons. You know, when they tested their hydrogen bomb in 2017, the day after that, they released a technical report on the EMP might of nuclear weapons, accurately describing how a super EMP weapon works. And they described their H-bomb as being capable of super EMP attack. Even before they tested the H-bomb, there was a lot of other evidence we don't have time to get into, but that the commission judged that Russia, China, and North Korea all probably have super EMP weapons. Now, this weapon is small enough to fit inside a North Korean satellite. For all we know, those satellites might already be armed. And it would detonate at high altitude, say at 300, 400 kilometers over the center of the United States, and this would create an electromagnetic field, a footprint on the ground that would cover all of North America, basically most of Canada, all 48 United States, and a good chunk of Mexico, with a field, an EMP field that is so intense that it could destroy, if it's a super EMP weapon, it potentially could destroy even protected electronics, you know, because it generates such powerful fields. Even our best military systems are only hardened to 50,000 volts per meter, whereas a super EMP weapon could generate 100,000 volts per meter and perhaps more. If it only destroyed the unprotected systems, that would take down the electrical grid, telecommunications, transportation systems, airplanes would fall out of the sky. In effect, it would think of an EMP weapon as an anti-technology weapon. It subtracts electronic technology from the equation of society, and we can't exist. We're an electronic civilization. We can't exist without our electronics. In the long run, in a year, it could kill most of the American people through starvation, disease, and societal collapse. Immediately, in a conflict or a confrontation, you know, it could paralyze our capabilities to even retaliate against North Korea. You know, we might not even know if they're the ones that attacked us with a satellite, because there's so many of them in orbit, and we can't see the thing coming. It sets up scenarios where you have to ask, well, gee, is it really North Korea or China or Russia or maybe even Iran doing a false flag operation to convince us that it's one of these other actors?
Right. So we might not have the knowledge of whom to retaliate against, let alone the capacity to do it. Now, Peter Pry, what you've just said is chilling, yet it is contested by some, including a group called the Electric Power Research Institute, better known as EPRI, which in a report a few months ago, once again, as they are wont to do, poo-pooed the threat from electromagnetic pulse and spoke rather authoritatively that actually the electric grid would be much more resilient than you're suggesting to this sort of attack from North Korea or even electromagnetic pulses that are naturally occurring as a result of the periodic intense solar storms that come our way. What do you make of this report and the fact that it seems to be the case that not only are people in the electrical utility industry now seizing on it as a justification for continuing to do next to nothing about such an eventuality, but evidently so are some in the United States government, who President Trump back in March ordered to start in a really comprehensive way protecting our grid against these sorts of threats.
Well, EPRI should have no credibility. You know, it's part of a vast lobbying operation that represents the electric power industry. It includes things like NERC, the North American Electric Liability Corporation, and EEI, the Edison Electric Institute, and EPRI itself. All of them are bought and paid for by the 3,000 utilities that run the electric national electric grid.
And this is an important point, Peter, if I could just interrupt you. Most of us don't have any idea that it isn't the government that runs the electric power infrastructure of the United States. Almost all of it is actually in private sector hands, right?
Exactly. And this is an old story. You know, whenever the government wants to impose regulation or requirements that are going to cost them money, you know, they will turn to their lobbyists. You know, they have over $300 million a year to spend on lobbying against Congress, in Congress, and then lobbying the American people. EPRI also, by the way, is not only bought and paid for by the U.S. utilities so that it'll churn out propaganda that supports their fiduciary interests, their financial interests, but they get 25% of their research budget from foreign actors. Russia and China, by the way, are members of EPRI, and they would very much like the United States to do nothing about protecting those electric grid. I'm really astonished that there are people who are supposed to be serious people in the Department of Energy who are charged with implementing President Trump's EMP executive order and protecting this country, that they would even listen to EPRI at all when it's got these foreign connections.
Yeah. I'm told, Peter Pry, that it's not just the Department of Energy. The Department of Homeland Security has also, I have heard, you know, inveighing in various ways against the threat that President Trump's executive order posits, and therefore, I guess, justifying their inaction in responding to his tasking to actually begin protecting the country against these kinds of threats. I mean, this it seems to be a classic example of the deep state at work. Is that right, as best you can tell? And what must President Trump do to overcome it?
It is that. It is the deep state at work, Frank. That's absolutely correct. And when we say the DHS and the Department of Energy, and there are other departments and agencies as well that are involved that in a conspiracy, basically to thwart the EMP executive order and what President Trump wants to do. But we shouldn't think that all of the thousands of employees there are part of this. It really boils down to a handful of people, many of them holdovers from the Obama administration. People who believe that climate change, for example, is the biggest threat and that are anti-nuclear in their bones and have never taken any nuclear threat seriously.
And fought tirelessly against the EMP Commission, for example, and its warnings over the, well, now 16, 17 years, I guess, right?
Yes, that's right. The solution, my preferred solution, and what I have recommended in writings is that these people be fired, you know. I don't know why the administration tolerates it, but they are, and putting up with it. A lot of people assume that, well, when President Trump signed that EMP executive order back on March 26th, the EMP war was won. Now the country was going to be saved. You know, I was more skeptical than that because I knew we had to get past these deep state bureaucrats and the very powerful influence that these lobbyists for the electric power industry have. You know, as I said, they've got hundreds of millions of dollars at their disposal. It's like EPRI and the electric power industry should have no more credibility than those independent laboratory assessments done for the cigarette industry back in the 50s and 60s that asserted that there was no causal link between lung cancer and cigarette smoking. They're exactly that intellectually dishonest. And we have written, the commission wrote rebuttals of the EPRI and reports and other reports that were generated by the government itself, by the Obama administration itself, that were junk science studies.
We will be following this story closely. Come back to us with updates if you would, Peter Pry. God bless you in the meantime. It's always good to talk with you, sir.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and we have the privilege of being joined by a man whose, well, renaissance qualities have been extraordinarily valuable to our country over a long period of time. He's been a tank officer in the United States Army, a judge advocate general. He's worked covert operations in the Central Intelligence Agency. He worked on the weapons of mass destruction terrorism threat, in charge of that portfolio at CIA for a time. He ran for Congress. He's the author of numerous books, including Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, and he is a prolific contributor to the public policy debate in America with outlets like The Hill and Newsmax, providing us platforms for Sam Faddis's very important insights. We're always pleased to have him with us, Charles Faddis, that is, Sam to his friends. It's good to have you back. Thanks so much for joining us, Sam.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, you've recently written a piece at each of those two publications that I wanted to talk with you a little bit about. Last week at The Hill, you had an interesting appraisal of what seems to be shaping up almost unremarked in the Middle East in terms of a reconfiguring of the traditional alliances. And I'd like you to walk through with us both what that reconfiguring looks like, both on our side and now increasingly on the bad guys' side, and what you think the implications of it may prove to be, particularly vis-a-vis the threat that we're all facing now from Iran.
Right. Well, as we all know, the press, by and large, does a horrific job of actually keeping us informed. And the scope of the Iranian threat and what the Iranians are doing all across the Middle East via all sorts of proxies really gets downplayed because it's inconvenient. And I think probably because it reflects very poorly on Barack Obama's tenure as president. So we just don't talk about it. But, you know, there's this vast Shia crescent forming across the Middle East, my formulation. Other people have used that phrase, which is really threatening the stability of the entire Middle East. And as a consequence, what you have now is an alliance forming. It's not just the United States and Saudi Arabia. It's not just the United States and Israel. It's actually all three of them working in concert, and in some cases, very, very effectively. I mean, we're really engaged in various ways against the Iranians and their proxies. So, you know, one of the clearest examples of that, I mean, it's a relatively small thing, but I think the symbolism is huge, is the fact that we recently returned American servicemen to a major air base in Saudi Arabia. For the first time in many, many years, we have flowed troops back in there to Saudi Arabia, which, you know, anybody can understand the symbolism of that and what the political implications were before understands that that is a really major step and shows how this is all forming up across the Middle East.
Well, and one of the upshots of it the last time around was, of course, Osama bin Laden using that as a pretext for, you know, his warfare against us, but also, I think, against the House of Saud. So, I mean, the Crown Prince, I guess, is driving this train, and further evidence of his determination to align with us, but also with the Jewish state, remarkably enough. There was a photograph the other day of the United Arab Emirates having an official actually holding hands with an uncovered Israeli minister, a female minister at that. And it's really an important and even perhaps tectonic shift. As importantly, perhaps, we're watching two longtime allies of the United States, at least putative allies in recent years, both of whom house major U.S. defense installations on their soil, Turkey and Qatar, which are now playing for the other team, as best I can tell. Your thoughts on that, Sam Faddis?
Well, I think that's very true. You know, you have a tendency, I think, in foreign policy and national security to assume that alliances and just sort of last forever, and so the Turks have been lined up with us since the Cold War, at least, and therefore somehow that's just carved in stone and it'll always be the case. Definitely not. We'll see exactly what happens. I think it fundamentally comes down to whether or not Erdogan stays in power, and that probably is going to be based more on domestic economy than anything else. But assuming he does stay in power, in large measure, I think the U.S.-Turkish alliance is done. I think that Incirlik, our air base in Turkey, is functionally useless now. I think the only reason, because the Turks won't let us do anything out of there. We've been pulling troops and equipment and other things out of there for a long time. And I think the only reason we don't close it is purely the symbolism that once it goes away, it'll never come back. So we're sort of hoping that Turkey changes course. But they and the Qataris right now are absolutely moving in the other direction. They are moving in a direction that places them in direct opposition to American policy in the Middle East.
Yeah, American policy and American security interests. It's worse than just being afoul of us on policy grounds. And Sam, there's so much more to talk about there, but this is a watch this space kind of story, because as things seem to be hotting up with the Iranians, these new alignments are definitely going to be factors in how it sorts. Let me switch gears quickly, Sam. We won't do justice to this topic either, I'm afraid, but just at least introduce it with your help to our audience. I have, in fact, talked on this program in the past with a woman by the name of Rosemary Gibson, who's done a really terrific book called China RX. But at Newsmax in recent days, you have expressed concern as well about the subject of her book, namely our dependence upon China for components of, if not finished products, vital to our healthcare system, namely antibiotics and penicillin and vitamin C and, as I say, other elements of drugs, to say nothing of, you know, the fentanyl that they're shipping in and so on. You've called it a poison factory, and that it is now recognized by the Defense Logistics Agency as a real threat to both our armed forces personnel and our veterans, and obviously to the larger American population as well. Give us just a quick appreciation of all that, if you would.
Right. So in addition to the whole fentanyl thing, which I guess people are generally aware of, which is the Chinese are in effect killing us in large numbers, we have this, first of all, this entire issue where basically we don't have any quality control whatsoever over the stuff that the Chinese is making that ends up in our veins. So even assuming good intentions, which I don't think we should assume, we're finding all sorts of horrific things in medications and having to recall medications that millions of Americans use. And literally what we're finding can kill you. But of course, there's the broader issue that you and I have touched on, which is, look, even if it's just they make all our penicillin and they're actually doing a good job, which is not true, there are massive national security implications about being dependent upon a nation that's not necessarily friendly for all kinds of things that you don't only need in peacetime, but your military is going to need in any war.
Look, not necessarily friendly, Sam Faddis, would be the best case. We're talking about people that, you know, the president himself in a tweet talked about as our enemies.
Well, they are. People ask me all the time when I'm speaking, you know, what's your number one national security threat? And I think they always expect me to say ISIS or Al-Qaeda or whatever. And I don't dismiss those. That's not where I'm going with this comment. But I always say 100% of the time, really strategically, right at this point in history, number one threat, communist China. And I always say it that way to remind people that it remains a communist state. I don't care what they make and sell us, they are not our friends. And being dependent upon them for medication, penicillin, drugs that will save your soldiers' lives is crazy.
And I guess, Sam, this just happens to be one of the most obvious supply chain train wrecks. The president, over the past couple of days, of course, has called for American companies to get out of China. I mean, it's the closest he's come so far to a very direct statement. We are decoupling from this place. But as you know so well, this is just one example of the kinds of dependencies that have been developed over the years, as though, you know, national security didn't matter a fig. And that's just totally irresponsible, malfeasant, reckless, dangerous. And I appreciate so much you being on this case. And I hope very much, Sam, that you will stay on it. And we'll be talking more about it with you, among many other things, in the day ahead. Thanks for joining us today. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.